Broadcasting from Manhattan Beach and the World Wide Web, you're listening to CHSR, HealthyLife.net.
As a service to our listeners, this program is for general information and entertainment purposes only. CHSRHealthyLife.net does not recommend, endorse, or object to the views, products, or topics expressed or discussed by show hosts or their guests. We suggest you always consult with your own personal, medical, financial, or legal advisor.
And good afternoon, good day, good evening, good morning. Thanks for tuning in. It's the November edition of Backbeat Radio. I'm Jake Cruz. You just found us here on HealthyLife.net, either live, streaming later at another time, or on the podcast on-demand platform. Backbeat, Word on the Street, and a whole lot of music news today. Of course, lots been going on, and, well, not as much going on musically as music fans would have liked to. Not a lot of tours. In fact, no tours. Some people are getting to get out and play in some spots locally. There has not been a lot of music releases, and, you know, industry shutting down maybe till next year. Hopefully things will be turning around the corner soon. Plans are always being made and checked into each and every day for bands to be out there getting back to entertaining and earning a way of life. One thing that has had a big spotlight on music throughout the year 2020 and pretty much each and every election year is the use of music and campaigns. And just because you're campaigning for office in the United States doesn't, in the USA, doesn't mean you're entitled to use Born in the USA, so to speak. Regardless of patriotism, artists often object to politicians using their music at campaign events, refusing to align themselves with an agenda or an entire political party. And again, sometimes they willfully step up and do so as well. A lot of this is from the article on loudwire.com that I ran across a few days back. Now, since rock musicians tend to be more liberal-minded, some, not all, maybe a majority, you'll notice the majority of these entries are musicians telling Republicans to, well, take this song and shove it. But artists such as Sting, Talking Heads, and Bikini Kill, actually, have raged against Democrats, even taking one of them to court for the unauthorized use of their music. And when the current heavily polarized election, rock musicians have run away from Donald Trump like the plague. Despite support from artists such as Ted Nugent and Kid Rock, a massive list of musicians, including Guns N' Roses, the Rolling Stones, and Ozzy Osbourne, recently have sent the 45th president cease and desist letters. I'm going to get into a list here in just a minute of some other artists who have demanded politicians stopping using their music and other campaigns in the past. Obviously, recently it's been every couple weeks. I think Tom Petty's estate had to put a cease and desist out there, and Phil Collins might have actually been in the latest. I might have another story on Phil Collins later if time allows. But here's a couple other politicians over the years who have been involved in some hullabaloos in past elections that might be, well, a little less personal than the current one we just are dealing with and faced. Twisted Sister, We're Not Gonna Take It. A lot of songs, of course, have been used, but We're Not Gonna Take It over the years has been used by many politicians. Twisted Sister ordered Mitt Romney, Paul Ryan, and Donald Trump to cease and desist their use of the song. Dee Snider even threatened to sue Australian politician Clive Palmer, adding that any pro-choice candidate has permission to use We're Not Gonna Take It. The Foo Fighters opposed the former presidential candidate John McCain's use of My Hero during the 2008 election, saying to have it appropriated without our knowledge and used in a manner that perverts the original statement of the lyric just tarnishes the song, said Foo's Fighters camp. We hope the McCain campaign will do the right thing and stop using our song and start asking artists permission in general. Parts Barracuda. Well, that showed up when Sarah Palin was running as John McCain's vice presidential candidate back in 2008 as well. Hart demanded that Sarah stop playing Barracuda at her rallies, saying Sarah Palin's views and values in no way represent us as American women, said Hart in their statement back then. The song Barracuda was written in the late 70s as a scathing rant against a soulless corporate nature of the music business, particularly for women. While Hart did not and would not authorize the use of their song at the RNC, Republican National Convention, there's irony in Republican strategists' choice to make use of that song there. Canadian rockers Rush got into the hullabaloo with Tom Sawyer when Rush gave Rand Paul a cease and desist order in 2010 while he was running for U.S. Senate in Kentucky. This is not a political issue, this is a copyright issue, Rush's lawyer stated. We would do this no matter who it is. Paul was one of many Tea Party candidates to win during the 2010 midterms. The Dropkick Murphys, their song Shipping Up to Boston. Their song was used and they sent anti-union Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker an extremely personal note after he used Shipping Up to Boston. The pro-union band tweeted to Walker, "We literally hate you." So they used the Twitter. They don't look like they actually used a cease and desist. Now, so far, it seems to be mostly Republicans getting the short end of the stick here, but here's some Democrats getting some backlash from Bikini Kill with the song Rebel Girl. While Hillary Clinton was running for president in 2016, the Democratic candidate used Bikini Kill's Rebel Girl in an ad. Bikini Kill drummer Toby Vail had the song removed, citing her support for Bernie Sanders. Van Halen's Right Now was also used, and back in 2008, Foo Fighters weren't the only band to deny John McCain as he ran against Barack Obama in 2008. Van Halen prevented Senator McCain from using Right Now as he campaigned for president, too. I've never heard of this band, but Explosions in the Sky apparently had a song called Your Hand in Mine that Texas Senator Ted Cruz used back in 2016 when he ran for president. His use of Explosions in the Sky's Your Hand in Mine was disputed by the band. We're absolutely not okay with it. Those are two people we don't like very much. We'll get to the bottom of this. The other individual the band referenced was Texas Governor Greg Abbott, who also used the song. My apologies to Explosions in the Sky. I've never heard of you. Bruce Springsteen, Born in the USA. Yeah, that's a big one. You figure everyone will be lining up for that one. It's an obvious go-to anthem for any American politician and patriotic person. But Springsteen has stopped Ronald Reagan, Bob Dole, and Pat Buchanan from using the song during each of their presidential campaigns. John Mellencamp, always a surly one. He stepped into it as well. If you're a Republican, don't expect permission to play John Mellencamp's music, period. The musician objected to both Ronald Reagan and John McCain's use of pink houses and later denounced George W. Bush's use of R-O-C-K in the USA. Well, Tom Petty's been involved when he was alive and since he's passed. The song American Girl got mixed up in the 2012 Republican presidential candidate Michelle Bachmann. And she didn't get far in her bid for the nation's highest office, but she did play Tom Petty's American Girl at a rally. Bachmann ignored Petty's cease and desist, unlike George W. Bush in 2000, who stopped playing I Won't Back Down after Petty objected to his song's use. Sam and Dave. They even got used on a campaign. Sam and Dave's Sam Moore is one of the rare artists to demand a Democratic candidate to stop using his music. During Barack Obama's 2008 presidential run, Sam Moore asked him to cease and desist. However, Moore later performed at Obama's 2009 inaugural ball, along with a 2013 gig at the White House. Sam and Dave, now those guys made a lot of good music back in the 60s, and at some point they quit talking to each other and only spoke basically musically on stage for basically the latter half of their career. Now, when it comes to getting a crowd fired up, it's pretty hard to ignore Survivor's Eye of the Tiger. So naturally, it seems like it would be used in a campaign, and Frankie Sullivan sued Newt Gingrich after he refused to stop playing Eye of the Tiger at his campaign events. Gingrich eventually settled with Sullivan once his 2012 campaign began to lose steam. Boston's more than a feeling. When former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee ran for president back in 2008, the Republican politician blasted Boston's more than a feeling at his rallies. Well, he could have been listening to any FM radio station since 1976. You can't go an hour without hearing Boston's More Than a Feeling. That's just my personal investigation has found that to be true. But nonetheless, Huckabee had it blasting at one of his rallies, and Boston has never endorsed a political candidate, wrote Boston founder Tom Schultz. And with all due respect, would not start by endorsing a candidate who is the polar opposite of most everything Boston stands for. So in a way, you know, the artists, by having their song used and then sending out the cease and desist order, kind of get a bigger sort of endorsement by pulling their music back. And while the politicians use the song, the people that are there that maybe don't know it's going to be pulled think, hey, that band likes my politician. It's a slippery slope. We did mention Sting at the top of the story. In 2000, Sting objected to George W. Bush's use of Brand New Day on the campaign trail. Bush's Democratic opponent Al Gore also used Brand New Day while running, but it's disputed whether or not Sting asked Gore to stop using the song. John Bon Jovi, who says you can't go home? Well, you can go home, said John Bon Jovi. Sarah Palin played the song at several of the former vice presidential candidate's rallies. John didn't like that. Again, want to thank Loudwire.com for this story on politicians using music without proper permission. Rock and roll is usually one of those things you don't have to ask for permission for. But nonetheless, the Eagles walk away. And this is one that seems to fit in the surreal category. The Eagles' Joe Walsh told Republican politician Joe Walsh to cease and desist his use of Walk Away. One of the Eagles' lawyers wrote to the Illinois congressman, "Now I know why you use Joe's music. It's undoubtedly because he's a lot better than any music you and your staff could have written, but that's the point. Since Joe writes better songs than you do, the Copyright Act rewards him by letting him decide who gets to use the songs he writes." It's got to be creepy when someone with the same name decides to use your song at a rally. Journey's Don't Stop Believin', you know that's a popular one. Newt Gingrich tapped that song in 2012 when he was running for the Republican presidential nomination. Journey's Don't Stop Believin' was blasting at campaign events. And they just think music is free, like a lot of other people on the planet, said the legal rep of singer Steve Perry in an interview with Variety. Talking Heads' Road to Nowhere, David Byrne is one of few artists to actually pursue legal action against a politician for using his music without permission. Florida Democrat Charlie Crist actually ended up paying David Byrne an undisclosed sum of money and posted an apology video to YouTube. And, various artists with Donald Trump. Countless musicians have asked President Donald Trump to stop using their music. A partial list of artists who've hit Trump with cease and desist include, and this is, I think, in alphabetical order, Aerosmith, The Beatles, Bruce Springsteen, Creedence Clearwater Revival, Elton John, Guns N' Roses, Leonard Cohen, Linkin Park, Neil Young, Nickelback, Ozzy Osbourne, Panic at the Disco, Phil Collins, Prince, Queen, R.E.M., The Rolling Stones, Tom Petty, Twisted Sister. And you might have guessed all of those, but I bet you didn't guess The Village People. Yep, Trump actually used Macho Man, not really knowing the meaning of the song Macho Man. And had he known that, I'm sure he would have ran from that song as fast as he could in the Village People would not have needed to send a cease and desist order. Just looking into some of the music that's been used on the political campaign in the past. If you've seen that Eagles documentary, History of the Eagles, there was a big hullabaloo between the Eagles members, Glenn Frey and Don Felder. Now, even within the Eagles, there's already two guys named Don. You got Don Henley, who he pretty much thinks he runs the show. He does have a great voice, and, he's going to remind you of it each and every time he can. Glenn Frey also had a great voice, wrote some of the songs. Don had some of the bigger hits. We got two guys named Don in the band. You got Don Henley, and you also got Don Felder. So, well, Don got to keep using the name Don. Felder was called Felder. So, you know, there's a little bit of animosity already built up along the years, and this is coming to a point where the Eagles are doing a benefit for then-California State Senator Alan Cranston. Glenn Frey wanted to do the benefit, volunteered the Eagles to do the benefit. Most of them thought, sure, we'll do a benefit. That seems fine. Felder, he didn't want to do the benefit, didn't want to be involved with any of the Eagles' music being involved in politics. You can actually check out that Eagles documentary. You might be able to find a short clip on YouTube of Glenn Frey and Don Felder literally getting in a fight on stage where there's words said during the middle of the song. And at some point, Glenn Frey turns to Felder and says, I'm going to be talking to you after the show, right there in the documentary. Remember when Bill Clinton got the Democratic nomination, or maybe it was when he won the whole election back in the 90s, Fleetwood Mac's Don't Stop Believin' was used, and there was no legal matters back then. Everyone seemed to be happy with him using it, and the band didn't seem to object. And a couple years ago, during Barack Obama's last run for president, Chris Cornell actually went out and played a number of benefit shows on his own while Soundgarden was on tour. He spent his own time to go out and do it, keeping away from band politics and doing it as a solo artist. And that was something volunteered on his own time. So, yep, many people have lent the cease and desist and have been appalled that their music has been used in without their permission. Should be the artist's choice if a song is to be used in a political rally, maybe at a football game, or a scene in the movie. You might think, oh, great, you know, that might be great to have my song in the movie. Hey, I'm just curious, you know, what's that scene going to be in the movie? And then you find out that it's maybe going to be something that you don't want to have your song associated with. Maybe it's going to be some graphic or horrific part of the movie, and you don't want to be part of that. Or, hey, it's going to be part of a really good scene, and it's probably going to end up helping some sales or enhancing the band's image with it. A lot of times just these quick little tidbits of music work for a couple minutes at rallies and get people fired up, and there you go. So in the political spirit, thought we would take a look into that today on Backbeat Radio here on HealthyLife.net. I'm Jay Cruz. If you're just tuning in, want to go back and catch the beginning or some past shows, you can always find them on the podcast on-demand link here at HealthyLife.net. We'll be back in a few. Backbeat Radio, Backbeat Word on the Street, and a whole lot of music news today.
What would happen if you didn't follow the established path? Would you feel scared? Are proud. Could you explain that helping the people of Peru improve their own community would also have an effect on your own? Would you rather make your own way or spend a lifetime saying, what if? Life is calling. How far will you go? Peace Corps. To find out more, call 1-800-424-8580 or go to peacecorps.gov.
Want help to quit smoking? Try premium e-cigarettes. They have an outstanding range of nicotine alternative products. Visit the HealthyLife.net advertiser page and click on Premium e-cigarettes.
For all your live or pre-recorded webcasting needs, come to earthchannel.com. Get your web-based message out to a select group or the whole world. It's easy. A pioneer in webcasting, earthchannel.com provides the best products and services to big corporations and government users. And now this same technology is available to you. They have the best Earthcast encoders, servers, and products to meet your technical needs. But wait, don't want to mess with technical stress? No problem. They'll do it for you. EarthChannel.com is your answer. You can use webcasting for lots of things like advertising, marketing, customer support, training, and don't forget, web radio and TV. In fact, you're listening to a live Earthcast right now. So come to EarthChannel.com. Actualize your audio or video webcasting needs today. You can't beat the friendly service or the price. Call earthchannel.com at 1-800-849-8978. That's 1-800-849-8978.
Yeah, it's Backbeat, Word on the Street, a whole lot of music news today on Backbeat Radio. I'm Jay Cruz. Recently, Cameron froze the August or September edition of Backbeat Radio. You can go on the archives and check it out and find out for sure. But I talked about a couple events in radio history. One of them was the infamous day I milked a cow at a San Jose Clash professional soccer game against a player on the team who had blown out his ACL and got to do that for a radio promotion. Another story was the night and subsequent night when Stevie Ray Vaughan died in a helicopter accident back in August of 1990. Well, someone else passing away sort of back in that same time of a helicopter accident was, from a lot of people outside of the San Francisco Bay Area or much past the 1960s, may or may not be familiar with the name of Bill Graham, one of the legendary rock promoters. Nope, not Reverend Billy Graham. Bill Graham, who was kind of worshipped and sort of had a high opinion of himself, like others in the past. But one of the most powerful, you know, music promoters, certainly on the West Coast, San Francisco area. He also promoted a number of national tours and managed a lot of acts specifically connected to the Bay Area in the 1960s music scene. He had opened the Fillmore East and the Fillmore West, both in East and New York, the Fillmore West and San Francisco. And he died in a helicopter accident back in 1991. And it was an interesting day because about a week later there was a huge memorial in Golden Gate Park in San Francisco. It was a free show. Pretty much anyone was invited to come. And pretty much everyone, nearly a million people, showed up into Golden Gate Park that day. All of the different radio stations, my station KOME, the other San Jose station KSJ was there, San Francisco stations KFOG, KRQR, KSAN, pretty much people from all the news talk stations, pretty much everyone was there broadcasting and covering and doing live cut-ins on their own various stations. Each station was broadcasting the concert for free, and the concert was literally a who's who of Bay Area history and music up at that time. And it was kind of one of those days where all competition between bands, all of the past squabbles of lineup changes and people getting kicked in and out of bands was put aside. All the competition between radio stations and we get to promote this concert and this is our event was all put aside. And it was kind of an interesting, kind of a positive day of celebration of life of Bill Graham for the whole music community, both the professional music makers, those who helped distribute the music from radio and the business end, and of course the fans. And Steve Perry of Journey actually was there and performed his last show with Journey on that day, which was November 3rd, 1991. It's an all-star concert to honor the late Bill Graham. The show came almost 5 years after Perry's last full concert with the band. That was February 1st, 1987. Now, the reunited group got together to pay tribute along with other artists who got their start in San Francisco, including Carlos Santana. Now, Carlos Santana played kind of in the morning, and that was right about when I got there, and Santana had just played, and then he came into the press tent to do a quick interview, and Bill Graham had been his manager, and of course he was very close, and he came into that press room, and I just remember, you know, here it is, Santana just came in, and he had this incredible glow of pure spiritual purification and happiness at the time that he had just put on an excellent show in his friend's memory. And as I remember, it was one of those things, kind of young at the time and not really knowing what I was actually witnessing at the moment, but it definitely struck me different as here's a person just coming in and the look on Santana's face is what he had just done, giving it all in a concert for his friend there. So Santana came in. I noticed I was also there to kind of record and interview Joe Satriani, another great guitarist. The Grateful Dead played that day, and the interesting thing about the Grateful Dead's performance, they played, and then they also had John Fogerty of Creedence Clearwater Revival come out, and John Fogerty had the Grateful Dead as his backup band for about a 25-minute set of CCR songs. That was kind of one of those that can only happen in San Francisco at a Bill Graham Memorial show. Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young were there, and of course that was all in celebration of the Bill Graham passing on October 25th in a helicopter crash. He was leaving a show at the Concord Pavilion along with a couple other people from his staff, one of which was a pilot, and they didn't quite make it. So back to Steve Perry and Journey. They hadn't played together since the end of their Raised on Radio tour, and even though their performance at the Graham tribute was brief, less than 10 minutes, and featured Faithfully, Lonely Road Without You, and Lights, it was a pretty big welcome return for fans who had been waiting for the moment since Perry retired from Journey, which broke up the following his departure. And following a 1994 solo album, Perry reunited on record with Journey's for 1996 Trial by Fire, which reached the top 20 and spawned a trio of hit singles. The band was all set to tour in support of the record, but after Perry injured himself in a hiking accident, well, the tour was canceled and Perry left for a second and final time. Journey continued with new singers, while Perry remained mostly quiet over the next 20 years, only making occasional appearances to sing Don't Stop Believin' with San Francisco Giants fans, were on stage with the indie rock band The Eels. And Journey were among the artists inducted in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2017, but Steve Perry declined to perform with the group on stage, and he finally returned to solo work a year later with Traces. Just an interesting day in history that happened to fall on the calendar. So that show with in San Francisco for the Bill Graham Memorial happened November 3rd in 1991. Also on early November back in 1975, pretty cool band that many people may or may not remember, featuring Rod Stewart. At one point, you'd have been hard-pressed to find a better rock and roll band than the Faces. Unfortunately, Rod Stewart and company came apart after one final early 1970s member defection. The final concert was on November 1, 1975 in Minneapolis. Now, in truth, even when the Faces' 1975 tour began in August, all parties must have had a sense that the end was near. Rod Stewart's tandem solo career was taking off, and Ron Wood had already taken a second gig, and he accepted that gig with the much bigger than almost all bands, the Rolling Stones. So the Faces hadn't recorded an album since 1973's popular Ooh La La, which Rod Stewart described as a bit of a mess. Founding bassist Ronnie Lane had gone since the summer of 1973, too. Then came a stop in Minnesota and the official end of a group whose records were pretty cool and genuine rock and roll as it could be, and whose live shows were often, well, inebriated celebrations, if you will. The Faces had grown out of the disillusion of the Small Faces in 1969 when singer-guitarist Steve Marriott left for Humble Pie. Ronnie Lane, drummer Kenny Jones, and the late keyboardist Ian McClagan then joined with frontman Rod Stewart and guitarist Ron Wood from the Jeff Beck Group, those two had been together there, to begin anew. With the newly rechristened Faces, Ragged Raunchy Rock and Roll Ride was immediately beset with trouble. Rod Stewart had started solo work before joining the Faces. By 1971, he was selling millions of records thanks to the hit single Maggie May and the album Every Picture Tells a Story. Before long, Rod was accused of keeping the best songs for himself, Stewart said in his autobiography, Rod. That was never the case, and logically it couldn't have been because I didn't write songs all the time, like proper songwriters. The late Ronnie Lane was replaced by Tetsu Yamachui, and the Faces never caught fire the way Stewart did as a solo act. Their 1974 single, You Can Make Me Dance, Sing, or Anything, the sole studio output from his lineup, reached number 12 in the UK, but failed to chart in the US. Then the Rolling Stones came calling after splitting with Mick Taylor. Actually, Mick Taylor left the Stones. The Stones had courted Ron Wood for ages, and their interest in him was certainly no secret, Rod Stewart remembered in Rod. I don't think anyone was surprised that eventually he couldn't resist or blamed him for joining the band. How many guitarists would have wanted to join the Rolling Stones? Now, Wood at first played in both bands, touring across America twice in the summer of 75. When the guitarist finally settled on his new gig, the Faces were no more. It's Backbeat, Word on the Street, and a whole lot of music news today on HealthyLife.net. We'll be right back.
A I'm William Shatner, and this is Jimmy. Animals like Jimmy are often left behind by people fleeing hurricanes, fires, floods, and earthquakes. These abandoned animals cannot survive on their own. If you must evacuate your home, please never leave an animal behind. If you absolutely cannot take your animal with you, never leave him helplessly chained or caged. Many animals die because they cannot escape fires or rising waters. Animals need your help. Thank you.
Call PETA today, 757-622-PETA.
See straight and save. These days, everyone seems to see things differently. But from your eyes, you can see straight and save. Right now, get glasses online at 70% off at Glasses USA. There's a 100% guarantee, too, on top brand men, women, multifocal, and even prescription sunglasses. Visit HealthyLife.net's advertiser page and click on Glasses USA, and you will see straight and save.
To get your message out, social media is great. But if you want to be picked up by major media outlets, let's face it, just using social media makes your chances, well, slim to none. If you want to improve your chances, put your message in the right place. A press release on PR Web. Affordable, easy to use, and with great customer service, there's no reason not to use PR Web. Visit HealthyLife.net's advertiser page and click on PR Web now and get started.
All positive talk with a mature edge. HealthyLife.net.
Backbeat, word on the street, and a whole lot of music news continues on HealthyLife.net. I'm Jay Cruz. Well, last month's show, we talked quite a bit about the passing of guitar legend, rock guitar legend, Eddie Van Halen. And, of course, still been a lot of talk in the music community of many musicians, fans, and whatnot, pouring tributes and reflections and some other things have even come from some of Eddie's past band mates, namely David Lee Roth has included music from five new songs as part of a newly launched web comic called The Roth Project. Apparently, it is a 17-chapter comic available to view now in both a scrolling and graphic novel-style format and a plain text version. It features material the Van Halen singer wrote and recorded several years ago with guitarist bassist John Five. I didn't know John Five played the bass. He's a heck of a guitarist. Who's played with David Lee Roth, Marilyn Manson, and Rob Zombie. The project alternates between these more traditional tunes like Giddy Up, Alligator Pants, and Low Res Sunset, and the recently issued Somewhere Over the Rainbow Bar and Grill, and atmospheric sections where Roth narrates in a deep, gravelly tone. Now, the story, written and vividly drawn, and David Lee Roth himself, is nearly impossible to describe, but it includes lots of war and apparently demons. This immersive interactive comic is a high-resolution visual and audio story. It's best experienced on a fast computer device and a fast internet connection. Read a description on the website. Put on your headphones and open your mind. Now, the music credits section includes details of the musical contributions from John Five on guitar and bass, Greg Bissonette on drums, Brett Tuggle on keyboards, and Louis Conte on percussion. I'm thinking some congos. That's what he specializes in. And the score for the comic was written and performed by David Lee Roth himself. Now, the singer previously dedicated Somewhere Over the Rainbow Bar and Grill to his late bandmate, Eddie Van Halen, saying, "Hey, Adam, gonna miss you," reads a text attached to the accompanying YouTube clip. See you on the other side. John Five discussed collaborating with Roth in a 2015 interview with Jude Gold in a No Guitar Is Safe podcast, saying they started working at the vocalist's home. John Five said, "I'd just go to his house and write these songs with him," and he would say, "All right, let's go in the studio." So we'd go to Henson's studio and record their songs. So they're actually pretty good. Some really great songs, and I'm glad they're finally out. And some other Van Halen news. Ed's son, Wolfie, or Wolfgang, his proper name, has been dealing with a lot of tough things, as you would expect from a son losing their father. Wolfgang Van Halen has been, unfortunately, his losing a father has been dealing with public opinion and music fans throwing in their two cents as well, as he's accused a magazine of turning the tragedy of Eddie Van Halen's death into entertainment. The late guitarist's son tweeted the cover of US Weekly, or Us Weekly, which led with a picture of Wolf's mom, actress Valerie Bertinelli, and claimed to contain her untold story of love, loss, and staying strong, including details of her dangerous marriage to Edward Van Halen. Of course, Wolfgang went off on a bit of a tirade on Twitter that we can't really repeat here on the radio. So, needless to say, he's kind of going through some tough stuff there. Other musicians have been telling some interesting stories about meetings and reflections of running across or playing with or going on tour with Eddie Van Halen. Recently, there'd been talk, and might be more talk, that we can get into when there's more talk, between David Coverdale and Jimmy Page, who, of course, had the Coverdale Page release back in the 90s, and David Coverdale of Whitesnake recalled the last time he met the late Eddie Van Halen, he and Jimmy Page were actually having tea in a hotel room. Sounds quite English. Coverdale also reflected on the aftermath of any respected artist's death, saying he still felt the presence of late bandmate John Lord of Deep Purple, who died in 2012. Coverdale says, "Edward, the last time I saw him, I was sitting in my hotel suite in London with Jimmy Page," he told Eon Music in a new interview. "It was like 10 in the morning, and we're just having a very elegant gentleman's cup of tea, teapot and everything. And the door to my suite goes, and Michael McIntyre, my co-producer, he gets up and opens the door, and the jaw hits the floor because he's a total Van Halen fan." Coverdale continued, "So Eddie goes, 'Hey, is David in?' And I wasn't under my own name. So Mikey walks in, and he goes, 'Oh, hey, it's Van Halen.' Edward just pushes past, and I go, 'Hey, Ed, how you doing?' And he goes, 'Hey, I'm all right. Good to see you. Hey, Jimmy Page, how are you?' So Van Halen grabbed a beer from the mini bar, even though it was around 10 a.m. It was England. Let's leave that under the jet lag. And he takes a Heineken out, and he's at Jimmy's feet as he picks up my acoustic guitar. And he's like, 'How do you play this thing, you know? And it's pretty amazing.' So I had Eddie Van Halen and Jimmy Page sitting there, and Eddie having a beer, and Jimmy and I with a cup of tea." Now, Coverdale said he'd known about Van Halen's cancer for quite some time, and he had discussed the situation with Sammy Hagar, saying Sammy still had the energy that he was going to have another opportunity to do the rounds as the singer with Van Halen, Coverdale said, "but I don't think Edward could do it." Asked how he felt about the deaths of musicians he knew, Coverdale said, "I really became aware more than ever about 2 years ago when I was remixing the Slide It In album, hearing John Lord's performances and studio dialogue and the interaction and laughs and all the joking. The thing is, they are as alive to me and my heart, my mind and my soul and my spirit. You know, the music's there, but artists, their music lives on. The sad thing is, you don't get to hug them, but I still talk to John, and I feel his presence every day of my life." Now, on the subject of how he'll be remembered after his own death, Coverdale reflected, "It's more important to me to be remembered as my wife's husband and my children's dad. That's the big deal to me. It's really important for me that people know I've always done my best, regardless if they think it's the best or not. It's the best I could do at that time, so I don't know if my legacy is going to be about music." Interesting reflection from David Coverdale there. Time for another break. It's Backbeat Radio, Backbeat, Word on the Street, and a whole lot of music news today on HealthyLife.net.
Carole King. The opportunity to study music is one of the most valuable things we can give our young people. Music is a positive outlet for creative expression. It reinforces teamwork, communication, self-discipline, and focus, all skills that will benefit them in every aspect of their lives. If your school has a music program, encourage your child to use it. If it doesn't, work with others in your community and do whatever it takes to get one. I know how much my music programs and music teachers meant to me when I was growing up. Leave your kids a note for the future. Support music programs and music teachers in your school and community.
A public service announcement brought to you by MENC, the National Association for Music Education, and this station. Music, part of a sound education.
For all your live or pre-recorded webcasting needs, come to earthchannel.com. Get your web-based message out to a select group or the whole world. It's easy. A pioneer in webcasting, earthchannel.com provides the best products and services to big corporations and government users. And now, this same technology is available to you. They have the best Earthcast encoders, servers, and products to meet your technical needs. But wait, don't want to mess with technical stress? No problem. They'll do it for you. EarthChannel.com is your answer. You can use webcasting for lots of things like advertising, marketing, customer support, training, and don't forget, web radio and TV. In fact, you're listening to a live Earthcast right now. So come to EarthChannel.com. Actualize your audio or video webcasting needs today. You can't beat the friendly service or the price. Call earthchannel.com at 1-800-849-8978. That's 1-800-849-8978.
All positive talk with a mature edge. HealthyLife.net.
And backbeat, word on the street, a whole lot of music news today, continuing with some tidbits, reflections, and some days and histories and a little bit of music news as a lot of bands are digging through their vaults. Just a minute ago, I was talking about a story David Coverdale remembered from the meeting of Eddie Van Halen when he and Jimmy Page were sitting around having a cup of tea, probably Page and Coverdale talking about the Coverdale Page album and release they did and tour back in the 90s. Well, it's been a little talk about them doing something else possibly as well, or unearthing some of their older songs, which leads to the next story involving Mr. Jimmy Page. When the CD revolution came along in the 80s, Jimmy Page was one of the many people to be intrigued by the promises made about the new format, and, well, he soon found himself disappointed. He was so disappointed, in fact, that he was inspired to start working on remastering Led Zeppelin's catalog himself in a bid to make the most of the digital platform. The first result was Led Zeppelin's box set, which was released in 1990. So there was a glut of dreadful CDs that suddenly came out in the 80s and 90s, he wrote in his new book, Jimmy Page, The Anthology. So the confidence trick was that the CDs were better than vinyl and cassettes. We were told that you could use them as a frisbee and they were indestructible and the sound quality was great. I remember getting a CD player and putting one on and thinking, they've got to be joking. So I continued to play vinyl, and he was moved to action after Atlantic Records released Led Zeppelin's catalog on CD by simply transferring archive recordings. So they sounded thin and atrocious, Page recalled. In one case, they'd even used a copy tape that had a whine on the left channel all the way through it. I said, we can't have this. It needed to be redone. So the guitarist and producer undertook a proper job by going back to the master tapes and reworking them so that you would be able to hear the songs the way you want to. And that spanned the 1990 box set. The remasters set released not long afterward and box set 2, which arrived in 1993. So it was important to being the musical legacy of Led Zepp up to date, Page explained. Now every track from our 9 studio albums could be heard on CD, having received the due care and attention needed to get the very best out of the format. So Jimmy was pleased to say that with the renaissance of vinyl, the computer companies tell you that CDs are dead. I also hear that cassettes are back on the rise, which is all wonderful. Page noted the same labels have even abandoned CDs in the wake of online streaming, which provided even more of a boost to the vinyl format. So it's funny, what goes around comes around. Did mention Tom Petty at the top of the show, being someone who had filed cease and desist orders against politicians, even from the grave, as a state filed one against President Trump on the recent campaign trail. And the recently released Wildflowers album has been on the charts for Tom, and kind of taking a look back at that album, and from a sonic standpoint, Tom Petty's recorded output from 1981 to 1991 is a Kind of a study in addition from the relatively stripped-down work he and the Heartbreakers turned out early in their career to the more layered approach they developed in the mid-80s to the layers of lush sound applied by producer Jeff Lynne on 1991's Into the Great Wide Open album. It's definitely a growth. And by the time Petty settled down to start work on what would become his second solo effort, 1994's Wildflowers, it was time to start subtracting. Commercially speaking, any tinkering with the Petty formula was a risky move. From the late 1980s onward, including his records with the Traveling Wilburys and his huge Full Moon Fever solo effort, he'd been omnipresent on rock radio, due at least partly to the stacks of harmonies and guitar jangle that Jeff Lynne helped apply. On the other hand, radio had changed quite a bit during the years he'd been away. The most popular new rock acts favored a rougher, rawer approach. Let's just call it what it is, grunge, and perhaps not coincidentally, that's exactly what Petty had in mind for Wildflowers. A simpler sound didn't necessarily mean an easier songwriting process. In fact, while Wildflowers sounds a lot more informal than anything Petty had done to that point, it required a deceptive amount of creative focus. It was a lot of work. 2 years, Petty told Paul Zollo in his book Conversations with Tom Petty. There's a lot more that came out, but yeah, I felt right in the pocket there. I was right in the zone, and I got a lot of good work done. We were very determined to bring that thing home. We, in this case, included new producer Rick Rubin, who had risen to prominence as a co-founder of the Def Jam label and helped break scores of hip-hop acts, including Beastie Boys and LL Cool J, before branching into rock production for acts like Slayer and the Red Hot Chili Peppers. And pretty much by this point, Rick Rubin has become famous for taking almost any classic rock artist that is kind of meandered and varied from their original sound 5, 6, 7 albums down the road. And Rick basically goes, you need to go back to your best record. That's what people want to hear. And somehow gets the artist to go back to their best record, because that's what artists are known for and what the listeners want to hear. So they were set up at Warner Brothers Studios with his newly founded Def American label. Rubin reached out to Petty's manager, Tony Dimitriadis, after hearing Petty would be leaving longtime label MCA for Warner's. So Petty and Rubin headed off after spending a day in the studio together and then embarked on a long journey that would find Petty recording as a solo artist, albeit one who was still working alongside pretty much everyone in his band for the second time in his recording career. Tom said, I think Rick and I both wanted more freedom than to be strapped into 5 guys. We wanted to be able to do whatever we wanted, really, as far as bringing in this guy or that guy, Petty explained. With a Heartbreakers record, you can't bring in a different bass player or a different drummer. So I wanted that freedom, and we did play with a lot of different musicians, and we even did a lot of trial and error with different musicians and auditioned people for the record. Now, calling the sessions just a casual process of getting together every afternoon for 2 years, Rubin told Rolling Stone magazine that he had a fairly clear idea of what he wanted Wildflowers to sound like from the beginning. So I just hoped we could have songs as good as Full Moon Fever, but with a more rock and roll and personal approach as opposed to a pop presentation. What seemed more natural to the Heartbreakers than the stuff that was done with Jeff Lynne? He has a strong personality, and he's brilliant at what he does. And you know it's Jeff Lynne, said longtime Heartbreaker Ben Montench, keyboard player, in an interview with Ultimate Classic Rock's Matt Warlaw. Tench said the Wildflowers record was more of a reset for Tom and for guitarist Mike Campbell, who'd been working very closely with Jeff, than it was for me. Wildflowers sounded for me more like the Heartbreakers. So I think it's one of the best things the Heartbreakers ever did. My taste leans in that direction, sounding more like just 2 guitars, bass, drums, and piano, Tench added. Even though there's a produced record, great attention was paid to detail, but that's kind of more my sensibilities lie. The Jeff records are great, and I'm not knocking Jeff Lynne at all, but I lean more toward the count for and play it type of approach. But as the best bands know, before you can just count for and play it, you have to really get your songs in order, and Rubin was also far more of a taskmaster than Petty had been used to. Petty said he pushed me, and I really think he got the best out of me. Sometimes he made me downright angry, Petty recalled. And it was just right some more. And he'd come to my house and want to hear all the demos. Okay, I like this one. I don't like this one. I like half of this one, so finish this. This is really good. Throw this one away. It was that way, and very song-oriented. and really an intelligent guy, a bright guy who I enjoyed working with and we're still good friends. Now, it wasn't all happy vibes surrounding Wildflowers. Drummer Stan Lynch, who'd been an outspoken critic of Petty's decision to go solo for Full Moon Fever, would see his long association with the Heartbreakers end before Wildflowers arrived, and it wasn't a decision that either Lynch or Petty arrived at quickly or easily. The mood between the two had soured well before Lynch's eventual termination following the band's October 2, 1994 show at the Bridge School benefit, Neil Young's benefit for the Bridge School in the Bay Area at the Shoreline Amphitheater in Mountain View. And Petty later recalled that after Lynch's final session with the Heartbreakers for the 1993 Greatest Hits bonus track, Lance Dance with Mary Jane, he left the studio without saying goodbye. So admitting that, in his view, Lynch never got over not being invited to play on Full Moon Fever, Petty described his longtime drummer's firing as more of a mutual parting of the ways. Said Stan and I always had a turbulent relationship, but it was part of the magic. But there came to be real tension in the music. We honestly couldn't function with each other. I did get mad at one point and sort of pushed him, but I didn't fire him. Stan needed a little shove to make that decision, and I only shoved because of the pain I could see him in, which eventually was causing me pain and problems. In a way, Stan left the room without saying goodbye, and I said to him, "Hey, listen, man, 20-year run is pretty good." Lynch's replacement in the Heartbreakers lineup, Steve Ferrone, arrived during the Wildflowers sessions, and Ben Montench told Ultimate Classic Rock his addition to the mix made a fundamental contribution to the album's departure in sound, saying he made a major difference in the feel and the groove. It's a drastically different feel. Now, in the charts, the results weren't drastically different at all. Released November 1, 1994, Wildflowers peaked at number 8 on Billboard's Top 200 Albums chart, outpacing Into the Great Wide Open by 5 spots and surpassing its double platinum certification by a million copies. And while the album had only one pop hit, the number 13, You Don't Know How It Feels, it extended Petty's dominant stretch at rock radio, where that single joined You Wreck Me and It's Good to Be King in a higher place in heavy rotation. After 2 years and no small amount of turbulence, Petty had yet another hit, and an album that many continue to point to as a highlight in his extensive catalog, including the late Petty himself. So it's my favorite, I think, of all of them, Petty admitted years later. I think it's my favorite just overall. We intended it to be two CDs, and we worked almost 2 years recording it and writing it. So I wrote a hell of a lot of songs. We recorded 21 or 22, I think. Looking back over all our work, to me, it's just one of the most satisfying things. You know, I like the other ones, but that one is the most me, I think. And that's me. That's where I live musically. Thanks for tuning in today to Backbeat Radio. I'm Jay Cruz, your host of the monthly show, heard at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, first Wednesday, each and every month here on HealthyLife.net. If you missed it, want to listen to it again, there's always the podcast on-demand link on the HealthyLife.net homepage that you can go back and listen to as well. Find us on Facebook, Backbeat Radio, and Backbeat _ Radio on Twitter. Jay Cruz, signing off till December with Backbeat Radio. Thanks for listening.
Over here. Here's a secret for a virus-free computer. ESET. They've been a pioneer in the antivirus industry for over 25 years. 25 years of innovative, top-rated antivirus protection. ESET's award-winning security solutions provide a safe online experience for over 100 million home and business computer owners. They are so affordable, fast, and simple to use. So be gone, you blue screen of death. ESET's on my computer. If it's not on yours, visit HealthyLife.net's advertiser page and click on ESET now.
When you need quality auto parts warehouse is fast and easy. Always get the part that fits. Just enter your vehicle type to find the parts specific to your car. Auto body parts, mirrors, brakes, suspension and steering, engines and drivetrains. Need something yet? What about exterior and interior accessories or headlights? Auto Parts Warehouse has them. Top brands, great prices. Visit HealthyLife.net's advertiser page and click on Auto Parts Warehouse.
All Positive Talk with a Mature Edge. HealthyLife.net.
A scrolling and graphic novel style format in a plain text version. It features material the Van Halen singer wrote and recorded several years ago with guitarist bassist John Five. I didn't know John Five played the bass. He's a heck of a guitarist, who's played with David Lee Roth, Marilyn Manson, and Rob Zombie. The project alternates between these more traditional tunes like Giddy Up, Alligator Pants, and Low Res Sunset, and the recently issued Somewhere Over the Rainbow Bar and Grill, and atmospheric sections where Roth narrates in a deep, gravelly tone. Now, the story, written and vividly drawn, and David Lee Roth himself, is nearly impossible to describe, but it includes lots of war and apparently demons. This immersive interactive comic is a high-resolution visual and audio story. It's best experienced on a fast computer device and a fast internet connection. Read a description on the website. Put on your headphones and open your mind. Now, the music credits section includes details of the musical contributions from John Five on guitar and bass, Greg Bissonette on drums, Brett Tuggle on keyboards, and Louis Conte on percussion. I'm thinking some congos. That's what he specializes in. And the score for the comic was written and performed by David Lee Roth himself. Now, the singer previously dedicated Somewhere Over the Rainbow Bar and Grill to his late bandmate Eddie Van Halen, saying, "Hey, Ed, I'm going to miss you," reads a text attached to the accompanying YouTube clip. See you on the other side. John Five discussed collaborating with Roth in a 2015 interview with Jude Gold in a No Guitar Is Safe podcast, saying they started working at the vocalist's home. John Five said, "I'll just go to his house and write these songs with him." And he would say, "All right, let's go into studio." So we'd go to Henson's studio and record their songs. So they're actually pretty good. Some really great songs, and I'm glad they're finally out. And some other Van Halen news. Ed's son, Wolfie, or Wolfgang, his proper name, has been, well, dealing with a lot of tough things, as you would expect from a son losing their father. Wolfgang Van Halen has been, unfortunately, his losing of father has been dealing with public opinion and music fans throwing in their two cents as well, as he's accused a magazine of turning the tragedy of Eddie Van Halen's death into entertainment. The late guitarist's son tweeted the cover of US Weekly, or Us Weekly, which led with a picture of Wolf's mom, actress Valerie Bertinelli, claimed to contain her untold story of love, loss, and staying strong, including details of her dangerous marriage to Edward Van Halen. Of course, Wolfgang went off on a bit of a tirade on Twitter that we can't really repeat here on the radio. So, needless to say, he's kind of going through some tough stuff there. Other musicians have been telling some interesting stories about meetings and reflections of running across or playing with or going on tour with Eddie Van Halen. Recently, there'd been talk, and might be more talk that we can get into when there's more talk, between David Coverdale and Jimmy Page, who, of course, had the Coverdale Page release back in the 90s. And David Coverdale of Whitesnake recalled the last time he met the late Eddie Van Halen, he and Jimmy Page were actually having tea in a hotel room. Sounds quite English. Coverdale also reflected on the aftermath of any respected artist's death, saying he still felt the presence of late bandmate John Lord of Deep Purple, who died in 2012. Coverdale says, "Edward, the last time I saw him, I was sitting in my hotel suite in London with Jimmy Page," he told Eon Music in a new interview. "It was like 10 in the morning, and we're just having a very elegant gentleman's cup of tea, teapot and everything. And the door to my suite goes, and Michael McIntyre, my co-producer, he gets up and opens the door, and the jaw hits the floor because he's a total Van Halen fan." Coverdale continued, "So Eddie goes, 'Hey, is David in?' And I wasn't under my own name. So Mikey walks in and he goes, 'Oh, hey, it's Van Halen.' Edward just pushes past and I go, 'Hey, Ed, how you doing?' And he goes, 'Hey, I'm all right. Good to see you.' Hey, Jimmy Page. Jimmy Page, how are you? So Van Halen grabbed a beer from the mini bar, even though it was around 10 a.m. It was England. Let's leave that under the jet lag. And he takes a Heineken out, and he's at Jimmy's feet as he picks up my acoustic guitar, and he's like, how do you play this thing, you know? And it's pretty amazing. So I had Eddie Van Halen and Jimmy Page sitting there, and Eddie having a beer, and Jimmy and I with a cup of tea. Now, Coverdale said he'd known about Van Halen's cancer for quite some time, and he had discussed the situation with Sammy Hagar, saying Sammy still had the energy that he was going to have another opportunity to do the rounds as the singer with Van Halen, Coverdale said, but I don't think Edward could do it. Asked how he felt about the deaths of musicians he knew, Coverdale said, I really became aware more than ever about 2 years ago when I was remixing the Slide It In album, hearing John Lord's performances and studio dialogue and the interaction and laughs and all the joking. The thing is, they are as alive to me in my heart, my mind and my soul and my spirit. You know, the music's there, but artists, their music lives on. The sad thing is, you don't get to hug them, but I still talk to John, and I feel his presence every day of my life. Now, on the subject of how he'll be remembered after his own death, Coverdale reflected, it's more important to me to be remembered as my wife's husband and my children's dad. That's the big deal to me. It's really important for me that people know I've always done my best regardless if they think it's the best or not. It's the best I could do at that time, so I don't know if my legacy is going to be about music. Interesting reflection from David Coverdale there. Time for another break. It's Backbeat Radio, Backbeat Word on the Street, and a whole lot of music news today on HealthyLife.net.
You're listening to HealthyLife.net. Millions of listeners know the secret. Now you do too. Positive talk 24 hours a day, every day.
Yeah, Backbeat Word on the Street. A whole lot of music news today. Continuing with some tidbits, reflections, and some days and histories and a little bit of music news as a lot of bands are digging through their vaults. Just a minute ago, I was talking about a story David Coverdale remembered from the meeting of Eddie Van Halen when he and Jimmy Page were sitting around having a cup of tea, probably Page and Coverdale talking about the Coverdale-Page album and release they did and tour back in the 90s. Well, it's been a little talk about them doing something else possibly as well, or unearthing some of their older songs, which leads to the next story involving Mr. Jimmy Page. When the CD revolution came along in the 80s, Jimmy Page was one of the many people to be intrigued by the promises made about the new format, and, well, he soon found himself disappointed. He was so disappointed, in fact, that he was inspired to start working on remastering Led Zeppelin's catalog himself in a bid to make the most of the digital platform. The first result was Led Zeppelin's box set, which was released in 1990. So there was a glut of dreadful CDs that suddenly came out in the 80s and 90s, he wrote in his new book, Jimmy Page, The Anthology. So the confidence trick was that the CDs were better than vinyl and cassettes. We were told that you could use them as a frisbee, and they were indestructible, and the sound quality was great. I remember getting a CD player and putting one on and thinking, they've got to be joking. So I continued to play vinyl, and he was moved to action after Atlantic Records released Led Zeppelin's catalog on CD by simply transferring archive recordings. So they sounded thin and atrocious, Page recalled. In one case, they'd even used a copy tape that had a whine on the left channel all the way through it. I said, we can't have this. It needed to be redone. So the guitarist and producer undertook a proper job by going back to the master tapes and reworking them so that you would be able to hear the songs the way you ought to. And that spanned the 1990 box set. The remasters set released not long afterward, and box set 2, which arrived in 1993. So it's important to being the musical legacy of Led Zepp up to date, Page explained. Now every track from our 9 studio albums could be heard on CD, having received the due care and attention needed to get the very best out of the format. So Jimmy was pleased to say that with the renaissance of vinyl, the computer companies tell you that CDs are dead. I also hear that cassettes are back on the rise, which is all wonderful. Page noted the same labels have even abandoned CDs in the wake of online streaming, which provided even more of a boost to the final format. So it's funny, what goes around comes around. Did mention Tom Petty at the top of the show, being someone who had filed cease and desist orders against politicians, even from the grave, as a state filed one against President Trump on the recent campaign trail. And the recently released Wildflowers album has been on the charts for Tom, and kind of taking a look back at that album, and from a sonic standpoint, Tom Petty's recorded output from 1981 to 1991 is a kind of a study in addition from the relatively stripped down work he and the Heartbreakers turned out early in their career to the more layered approach they developed in the mid-80s to the layers of lush sound applied by producer Jeff Lynne on 1991's Into the Great Wide Open album. It's definitely a growth. And by the time Petty settled down to start work on what would become his second solo effort, 1994's Wildflowers, it was time to start subtracting. Commercially speaking, any tinkering with the Petty formula was a risky move. From the late 1980s onward, including his records with the Traveling Wilburys and his huge Full Moon Fever solo effort, he'd been omnipresent on rock radio, due at least partly to the stacks of harmonies and guitar jangle that Jeff Lynne helped apply. On the other hand, radio had changed quite a bit during the years he'd been away. The most popular new rock acts favored a rougher, rawer approach. Let's just call it what it is, grunge, and perhaps not coincidentally, that's exactly what Petty had in mind for Wildflowers. A simpler sound didn't necessarily mean an easier songwriting process. In fact, while Wildflowers sounds a lot more informal than anything Petty had done to that point, it required a deceptive amount of creative focus. It was a lot of work. 2 years, Petty told Paul Zollo in his book Conversations with Tom Petty. There's a lot more that came out, but yeah, I felt right in the pocket there. I was right in the zone, and I got a lot of good work done. We were very determined to bring that thing home. We, in this case, included new producer Rick Rubin, who had risen to prominence as a co-founder of the Def Jam label and helped break scores of hip-hop acts, including Beastie Boys and LL Cool J, before branching into rock production for acts like Slayer and the Red Hot Chili Peppers. And pretty much by this point, Rick Rubin has become famous for taking almost any classic rock artist that is kind of meandered and varied from their original sound 5, 6, 7 albums down the road. And Rick basically goes, you need to go back to your best record. That's what people want to hear. And somehow gets the artist to go back to their best record, because that's what artists are known for and what the listeners want to hear. So they were set up at Warner Brothers Studios with his newly founded Def American label. Rubin reached out to Petty's manager, Tony Dimitriadis, after hearing Petty would be leaving longtime label MCA for Warner's. So Petty and Rubin headed off after spending a day in the studio together and then embarked on a long journey that would find Petty recording as a solo artist, albeit one who was still working alongside pretty much everyone in his band for the second time in his recording career. Tom said, I think Rick and I both wanted more freedom than to be strapped into 5 guys. We wanted to be able to do whatever we wanted, really, as far as bringing in this guy or that guy, Petty explained. With a Heartbreakers record, you can't bring in a different bass player or a different drummer. So I wanted that freedom, and we did play with a lot of different musicians, and we even did a lot of trial and error with different musicians and auditioned people for the record. Now, calling the sessions just a casual process of getting together every afternoon for 2 years, Rubin told Rolling Stone magazine that he had a fairly clear idea of what he wanted Wildflowers to sound like from the beginning. So I just hoped we could have songs as good as Full Moon Fever, but with a more rock and roll and personal approach as opposed to a pop presentation. What seemed more natural to the Heartbreakers than the stuff that was done with Jeff Lynne. He has a strong personality and he's brilliant at what he does. And you know it's Jeff Lynne, said longtime Heartbreaker Ben Montench, keyboard player, in an interview with Ultimate Classic Rock's Matt Warlaw. Tench said the Wildflowers record was more of a reset for Tom and for guitarist Mike Campbell, who'd been working very closely with Jeff, than it was for me. Wildflowers sounded for me more like the Heartbreakers. So I think it's one of the best things the Heartbreakers ever did. My taste leans in that direction, sounding more like just 2 guitars, bass, drums, and piano, Tench added. Even though there's a produced record, great attention was paid to detail, but that's kind of more my sensibilities lie. The Jeff records are great, and I'm not knocking Jeff Lynne at all, but I lean more toward the count-for-and-play-it type of approach. But as the best bands know, before you can just count four and play it, you have to really get your songs in order, and Reuben was also far more of a taskmaster than Petty had been used to. Petty said he pushed me, and I really think he got the best out of me. Sometimes he made me downright angry, Petty recalled. It was just write some more. And he'd come to my house and want to hear all the demos. Okay, I like this one. I don't like this one. I like half of this one, so finish this. This is really good. Throw this one away. He was that way and very song-oriented and really an intelligent guy, the bright guy who I enjoyed working with and we're still good friends. Now, it wasn't all happy vibes surrounding Wildflowers. Drummer Stan Lynch, who had been an outspoken critic of Petty's decision to go solo for Full Moon Fever, would see his long association with the Heartbreakers end before Wildflowers arrived, and it wasn't a decision that either Lynch or Petty arrived at quickly or easily. The mood between the two had soured well before Lynch's eventual termination following the band's October 2, 1994 show at the Bridge School benefit, Neil Young's benefit for the Bridge School in the Bay Area at the Shoreline Amphitheater in Mountain View. And Petty later recalled that after Lynch's final session with the Heartbreakers for the 1993 Greatest Hits bonus track, Lance Dance with Mary Jane, he left the studio without saying goodbye. So admitting that, in his view, Lynch never got over not being invited to play on Full Moon Fever, Petty described his longtime drummer's firing as more of a mutual parting of the ways. Said, Stan and I always had a turbulent relationship, but it was part of the magic. But there came to be real tension in the music. We honestly couldn't function with each other. I did get mad at one point and sort of pushed him, but I didn't fire him. Stan needed a little shove to make that decision, and I only shoved because of the pain I could see him in, which eventually was causing me pain and problems. In a way, Stan left the room without saying goodbye, and I said to him, hey, listen, man, 20-year run is pretty good. Lynch's replacement in the Heartbreakers lineup, Steve Ferrone, arrived during the Wildflowers sessions, and Ben Montench told Ultimate Classic Rock his addition to the mix made a fundamental contribution to the album's departure in sound, saying he made a major difference in the feel and the groove. It's a drastically different feel. Now, in the charts, the results weren't drastically different at all. Released November 1, 1994, Wildflowers peaked at number 8 on Billboard's Top 200 Albums chart, outpacing Into the Great Wide Open by 5 spots and surpassing its double platinum certification by a million copies. And while the album had only one pop hit, the number 13, You Don't Know How It Feels, it extended Petty's dominant stretch at rock radio, where that single joined You Wreck Me and It's Good to Be King in a higher place in heavy rotation. After 2 years and no small amount of turbulence, Petty had yet another hit, and an album that many continue to point to as a highlight in his extensive catalog, including the late Petty himself. So it's my favorite, I think, of all of them, Petty admitted years later. I think it's my favorite, just overall. We intended it to be two CDs, and we worked almost 2 years recording it and writing it. So I wrote a hell of a lot of songs. We recorded 21 or 22, I think. Looking back over all our work, to me, it's just one of the most satisfying things. You know, I like the other ones, but that one is the most me, I think. And that's me. That's where I live musically. Thanks for tuning in today to Backbeat Radio. I'm Jay Cruz, your host of the monthly show, heard at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, first Wednesday, each and every month here on HealthyLife.net. If you missed it, want to listen to it again, there's always the podcast on-demand link on the HealthyLife.net homepage that you can go back and listen to as well. Find us on Facebook, Backbeat Radio, and Backbeat_Radio on Twitter. Jay Cruz, signing off till December with Backbeat Radio. Thanks for listening.